This is a book review by Heshy Zeltzer of The Jewish Enlightenment by Shmuel Feiner. The Enlightenment, which began during the 18th century in France, Britain, and Germany, advocated reason as the primary basis of authority. Eventually, Enlightenment ideals spread throughout Europe, then to Russia and the United States, where they influenced the American Founding Fathers and had a profound effect on the drafting of the Bill of Rights. Immanuel Kant summarizes the philosophy of Enlightenment as follows. Enlightenment is man's release from his self-incurred tutelage. Tutelage is man's inability to make use of his understanding without direction from another. Self-incurred is his tutelage when its cause lies not in lack of reason, but in lack of resolution and courage to use it without direction from another. Have the courage to use your own reason. That is the motto of Enlightenment. End quote. Haskalah, the Jewish manifestation of the Enlightenment, came about in the wake of the external pressure of the European Enlightenment and eternal strife brought about by the Messianic and Hasidic movements. Together, these pressures led to a breakdown in the structure of the Kehillah and a decline in the authority of the rabbinate. Shmuel Feiner's book, The Jewish Enlightenment, discusses the original 18th century Haskalah as manifested in Germany. Unlike some other recent books that focus on a specific aspect of the Haskalah, Feiner's work presents the German Haskalah in all its rich detail. How did the Haskalah affect the Jewish community? Lucy Davidowitz, in her introduction to The Golden Tradition, Jewish Life and Thought in Eastern Europe, writes as follows. The rapid abandonment of Yiddish and then Hebrew, of belief in the Messiah's coming, and in the unity of the Jewish people, did not guarantee entry into Christian society. For not enlightenment, but apostasy was the right price of admission to Gentile society. Many enlightened Berlin Jews had little difficulty paying that price. The Mendelssohnian Haskalah set off an epidemic of voluntary conversions unparalleled in Jewish history. Some Mendelssohnians, like David Friedlander, hesitated to plunge into the baptismal waters. Friedlander proposed in the name of enlightenment, reason, and warm feeling, their wholesale baptism and conversion on condition that they be excused from believing in the divinity of the Christian Messiah. The Protestants were not interested. Friedlander died a Jew, but all his children converted unconditionally. End quote. Beryl Wien, in his Survival, The Story of the Jews in the Modern Era, writes as follows. All of the falseness of the Enlightenment and its benefits for Jewry would be mirrored in the story of Mendelssohn. He loosed forces that would be destructive to myriads of Jews individually and to the Jewish people as a whole. The harshness of Jewish history's judgment upon him as a reflection of the incipient disaster that he was so prominent in fashioning. He saw himself as a hero to his people. History would cast him differently. Yet Mendelssohn is viewed, and correctly so, as the father of Reformed Judaism. Some of his own children became Christians. He opened the gates to the torrent of assimilation into marriage that characterized Western European Jewry in the 18th and 19th centuries. His name became a symbol of change and controversy, and eventually a cruel hoax. He was convinced that since he, Mendelssohn, could remain moderately observant and openly Jewish at the court of the emperor and in the leading intellectual salons of Europe, all other Jews could and would do so as well. However, when the Enlightenment was loosed upon the masses of Jewry, many of whom were ill-prepared to deal with the new world unless they could discard their old one, it would have tragic consequences. End quote. That Mendelssohn was only moderately observant, or that he was the father of Reformed Judaism, is an obvious inaccuracy. But what about the other assertions? Was Mendelssohn really responsible for fashioning the Haskalah? Did the Haskalah cause the torrent of assimilation and intermarriage? Both of those assumptions are firmly entrenched in Orthodox consciousness and date back to the dawn of the Haskalah. Sorkin, for example, points out that Joseph Mendelssohn, in the biography of his father, portrays Moses Mendelssohn as the father of the Haskalah. Feiner, in his introductory chapter, writes that the claim that the Haskalah led to assimilation and apostasy originated as soon as the Haskalah movement came into being. Are those long-established assertions true? Feiner believes they are not. To understand his reasoning, it is necessary to review the history and dynamics of both the Enlightenment in general and the Haskalah in particular. Chapter begins Jewish life at the dawn of the Haskalah. At the beginning of the 18th century, most European Jews lived in restricted settlements and urban ghettos, isolated from the surrounding dominant Christian culture, not only by law, but also by language, custom, and dress. In 1702, a special permit was required for a Jew to study in a university in Germany. In that year, only one Jewish student, Shmuel Shimon Ben Yanko from Poland, was enrolled at the University of Frankfurt on Oder, and only a single Jewish student, Isaac Wallach of Koblenz, was enrolled in Halle University. In fact, from 1678 to 1730, only 25 Jews were enrolled in a total of 5 universities. A decree issued in Berlin in 1760 and still in force in 1802 stated that, quote, as the merchant's guild is to be composed of honest and honorable persons, the following must be barred from membership: Jews, homicides, murderers, thieves, perjurers, adulterers, or any other person afflicted with great public vices or sins, end quote. Mendelssohn, in his preface to the German translation of Menashe's work, more on this later, expresses frustration concerning the oppressive discrimination against Jews. Quote, people continue to keep us away from every contact with the arts and sciences or from engaging in useful trades and occupation. They bar all roads leading to increased usefulness and then use our lack of culture to justify our continued oppression. They tie our hands and then reproach us for not using them. End quote. The Enlightenment called for equal rights for the common man and for freedom from religious persecution. John Locke, for example, believed that religious coercion by the ruling authority has no validity. However, the call for rights and freedoms were not necessarily meant to include the Jewish population. Even when Jews were included, it was not without a price. Voltaire fought zealously against the misdeeds of the church, but as far as the Jews were concerned, he believed that their centuries-long corrupt character was irremediable, and that the Jews possessed values that were diametrically opposed to those of the Enlightenment. In October 1781, Emperor Joseph II, from the court of Vienna, issued the Edict of Tolerance toward the Jews of Bohemia, and in January 1782, another Edict of Tolerance toward the Jews of Austria. However, these edicts did not go far enough. Restrictions against Jews in Vienna were not removed, and the emperor expressed the hope that the Jews would convert within 2 decades. English deists constantly depicted Judaism in an unfavorable light, as did Voltaire. In contrast, German deists generally held more liberal views. For example, Christian Wilhelm von Dohm, author of On the Civil Improvement of the Jews, was a champion for Jewish tolerance and rights. Next chapter, Pre-Haskalah, rabbinic calls for reform in Jewish education and an appreciation for the sciences. Even before the Age of Enlightenment, some rabbinic leaders called upon their communities to modify their educational curriculum. For example, the Maharal had deep reservations about the curriculum of Ashkenazic Jews in Central and Eastern Europe, whose exclusive concentration on Talmud study was designed to turn every student into a Talmud Chacham. He believed that the curriculum should include Bible and Mishnah study, and toward that aim he prepared a Hebrew grammar book for children. He also took exception to the causistic method of Talmud study, Pilpul, because he thought it would compromise the truth and morality of the legal tradition. He acquired a significant knowledge of mathematics and natural sciences, and regarded astronomy as, quote, a ladder on which to ascend to the wisdom of the Torah, end quote. He considered them divinely ordained bodies of knowledge to be treated as subordinate to Jewish studies, but nevertheless necessary for the proper study of Bible and Talmud. The Vilna Gaon insisted that everyone should first master the 24 books of the Bible, their etymology, purpose, syntax, then the 6 divisions of the Mishnah with the important commentaries and suggested emendations, and finally the Talmud in general, without wasting much time on Pilpul, which brings no practical result. Furthermore, the Gaon exhorted the Talmudic scholar to study secular sciences, since, quote, if one is ignorant of the other sciences, one is a hundredfold more ignorant of the science of the Torah, for the two are inseparably connected, end quote. He wrote not only on the most important Hebrew books, biblical, Talmudic, and Kabbalistic, but also on algebra, geometry, trigonometry, astronomy, and grammar. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was opposed in principle to Jews pursuing academic studies and stressed the religious dangers facing a Jew in a European university. However, his objection to secular studies was neither all-encompassing nor absolute. He differentiated between philosophy, which he felt was not proper to study, and the sciences, and especially medicine, which he viewed as permissible. When Benjamin Wolf Ginsberg, a medical student in Göttingen University, wrote in 1937 to Rabbi Emden in Altona regarding the permissibility of observing an anatomy lesson on the Sabbath, the latter was unable to conceal his envy of the young student who was in the company of scholars surrounded by books of science. He urged Ginsberg to find in academia answers to questions that had been troubling him. For example, how reliable was alchemy as an exact science? At the end of his long halachic response, Rab Emden was unable to contain his own desire for knowledge. Quote, like you, I also crave to enter into a covenant with the sciences and to cleave onto them with love. I long to delve into the depths of scientific research, to uncover its secrets, to quench my thirst, and to take my pleasure. But the sciences have despised me and have not let me come into them after the manner of all flesh, and have banished me, driving me away with both hands as if I were a worthless person. End quote. However, years later, Emden wrote, quote, let thousands of such physicians and their words be set aside and vanish, but not to harm a single letter of the Torah. Heaven forbid that our perfect Torah should be likened to their idle talk, or that one should believe in their utterances and trust their wisdom. What is this wisdom of theirs? It cannot withstand the power of the wisdom of our rabbis of blessed memory, the sages of the truth. End quote. Next chapter, Moses Mendelssohn, the icon of the Haskalah. There is no one in the history of modern Jewish thought quite like Moses Mendelssohn. His appearance would not be considered handsome, but he won people over with his kindness, wit, and modesty. As a student of Rabbi David Frankel, the author of Carbon Aedon the Yerushalmi, he followed him from Dessau to Berlin, where he was tutored in philosophy by Israel Zamosk and Aaron Solomon Grumpertz. In Berlin, Mendelssohn became a tutor in the household of Isaac Bernhard. He would later become a bookkeeper in Bernhard's silk factory and eventually its manager. Although mostly self-taught, Mendelssohn was unique in being the only important thinker to combine adherence to the rational philosophy of the German Enlightenment with loyalty to Judaism. Mendelssohn also attained great prominence outside the Jewish world and was widely known as the German Socrates. He was a devoted disciple of the works of Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz and Christian Wolff, and was described by Kant as the most perfect product of that school. He followed his mentors in emphasizing the importance of rational proof of the existence of God, divine providence, and immortality of the human soul. Demeaning Prussian laws made life oppressive for the Jews, and even Mendelssohn was not immune. Despite his great reputation, Frederick the Great refused to acknowledge Mendelssohn as a bona fide Prussian intellectual and blocked his appointment to the Academy of Sciences. Living in Berlin was also a problem. A long time passed before Mendelssohn was finally awarded a Prussian Schutzhut, granting him immunity from deportation. In a letter to Benedictine brother Morris Winkop, Mendelssohn relates how, despite all his efforts, the behavior of the Gentile on the street seemed hardly to have changed. Quote, once in a while I take an evening stroll with my wife and family. Papa, one of my children, asks innocently, what is that fellow over there yelling after us? And why do these people throw stones at us? What have we done to them? Yes, Papa dear, another speaks up. They always follow us in the streets and call us names. They cry, Jews, Jews. Do you think it bad to be a Jew? Why else would they keep away from us? Alas, averting my eye, I sigh to myself, man, oh man, is that what you have finally accomplished? End quote. Although Mendelssohn was keenly aware of the anti-Semitism of his society, he never imagined the creation of a Jewish state as a solution to that problem. On two separate occasions, he voiced his opposition to Zionism, once on religious grounds, and the other time on practical considerations. That ambivalence towards Zionism would remain a hallmark of German Jewry for the following 175 years. From the first appearance in the public sphere until his dying day, his struggle for religious tolerance toward the Jews was foremost in his mind. That struggle was more than just altruistic, as Mendelssohn himself was also subject to religious intolerance. When Lavater, a supposed close friend, called upon Mendelssohn to either convert or refute the main tenets of Christianity, Mendelssohn was forced to defend his Jewish beliefs, and he publicly declared that there was not even the slightest chance that he would abandon the faith of his forefathers. Nevertheless, Mendelssohn did to a large extent enjoy religious toleration. He was a member of the popular Enlightenment clubs and a close friend of some of their most important members. After collaborating with Christian Wilhelm Dohm on a memorandum in support of the Jewish community in Alsace, Mendelssohn asked Dohm to prepare a general treatise on the Jews' legal status. Dohm's On the Civic Amelioration of the Jews stimulated the public discussion Mendelssohn desired. To reinforce the impact of Dohm's tract and Joseph II's Edict for the Jews of Bohemia, Mendelssohn published a German retranslation of a pamphlet of Menashe ben Israel, a 17th century rabbi in Amsterdam, whose defense of the Jews helped them gain readmission to England. In his preamble, Mendelssohn advocated civic acceptance for the Jews and argued to end the prejudice that impeded the granting of rights. He asserted that economic and civic freedom were inextricably linked and declared that no religion should have the power to issue a ban of excommunication, since religious opinions and beliefs were not subject to external authority. Mendel's Phaedon, or The Immortality of the Soul, was a popular book offering a new doctrine of salvation for a Christian society that had been turning ever more secular. And Phaedon's starting point for proving the immortality of the soul was a certainty of the existence of God. It was the most popular book in its time, and in 2 years it ran through 3 editions. It was immediately translated into many European languages and also into Hebrew. Christian theologians, philosophers, artists, and poets were enamored of it. They enthusiastically thanked the Jewish sage who had restored to them the comfort which Christianity no longer afforded them. However, among Jewish sages, the praise was not so forthcoming. Mendelssohn had declared that he had found in Judaism certain human conditions and abuses that only served to diminish its splendor. That expression offended many and caused some to question his orthodoxy. Mendelssohn's first two Hebrew works were related to philosophy and logic. His first Hebrew book, Kohelet Musar, was the first modern journal in Hebrew, although only 2 issues were published. It addressed students of Talmud and those adept at Jewish learning in some of the same philosophic concepts he had previously addressed in his German works: nature as a source of enjoyment or belief, evil and misfortune in daily life, and the nature of relationships between man and man and between man and God. Mendelssohn's second work, written in 1760-61, was a commentary on Maimonides' Milot HaHikayon, in which he attempted to put Maimonian philosophical thought into Leibnizian Wolffian terminology. He regarded logic as an instrument and not as an end in itself, and recommended that students study logic an hour or so each week. In his commentary on Ecclesiastes, Mendelssohn focused on the ideas of providence and immortality. He defended the tradition of Jewish biblical exegesis that posited 4 possible modes of interpreting biblical texts: literal, homiletic, allegorical, and esoteric. He argued that the multiple meanings are inherent in the words, and he employed Maimonides' categories of primary and secondary intention to explain how this is possible. Mendelssohn wrote his Jerusalem, or On Religious Power and Judaism, to explain how his political liberalism is compatible with his loyal adherence to Judaism. In Jerusalem, Mendelssohn argued in favor of religious freedom, that the church slash synagogue should not have any ecclesiastical powers to coerce its members and force strict separation of church and state. Mendelssohn then set out to show that Judaism is consistent with religious tolerance and that Judaism is a natural religion, i.e. that its religious and moral principles could be logically deduced without the need of revelation. He argued that unlike Christianity, Judaism contains no revealed dogma, only revealed legislation. This he famously summed up as follows, quote, "I believe that Judaism knows nothing of a revealed religion in the sense in which Christians understand this term. The Israelites possess a divine legislation, laws, commandments, ordinances, rules of life, instructions in the will of God as to how they should conduct themselves in order to attain temporal and eternal felicity. What was revealed to them through Moses were rules and precepts of this kind, not doctrines, saving truths, or universally valid propositions of reason. These the Eternal One reveals to us and all other men at all times through the nature of things, but not through the spoken or written word of revelation." End quote. Jerusalem concluded with a fervent appeal to his fellow Jews to remain loyal to the religion of their fathers, no matter what the cost. Better to forgo the benefits of civil equality than to be disloyal to Judaism. In the Book of Paths of Peace, Mendelssohn translated the Pentateuch into German using Hebrew letters and wrote the introduction, which he titled Light for the Path. From 1778, for 6 years, with a group of scholars, he worked on its Hebrew commentary, which he called the Bier. Part of that commentary he wrote himself, and the balance he edited. Mendelssohn believed that the Bible had been composed according to a set of principles that were known to the Jewish exegetical tradition. He also argued forcefully that the Torah was not, as claimed by others, knit together from different documents distinguished by the various names of God. Mendelssohn knew from the start that this publication would cause him much grief. In a letter to Avigdor Levi, written in the summer or early fall of 1781, Mendelssohn writes, quote, "As soon as I had permitted Rabbi Solomon Dubnow to publish my translation, I put my life in my hands. I lifted up mine eyes onto the mountains, and I gave my back to the smiters. Alas, I knew how much opposition, hatred, persecution, etc., is engendered among the public by the least innovation, no matter how important the improvement it seeks to foster." End quote. The innovations to which he was referring were that he was translating the Bible into a pure and refined German, albeit in Hebrew characters, and that he was rendering the Tetragrammaton, the holiest name of God, as, quote, "the Eternal One." Mendelssohn gave different reasons for publishing the Book of the Paths of Peace. In a letter to Avigdor Levi of Prague in mid-1779, he wrote that, quote, "I translated the Bible into German, not out of pride in the task or to make a name for myself, but for my children that God has bestowed upon me. And here, by the will of God, there came to my acquaintance the learned Shlomo Dubnow, to whom I entrusted my son Joseph, that he might take daily lessons from him in Hebrew. And when this rabbi learned of my translation, it found favor in his eyes, and he urged me to publish it for the benefit of Jewish children, who had need of a biblical commentary and translation in German that would surpass and replace the misleading books of the Gentiles." End quote. To August Hennings, a member of Danish government, Mendelssohn wrote that, quote, "This is the first step to culture from which, alas, my nation has held itself aloof, though one might almost despair of any possibility of improvement." End quote. Sorkin claims that the often misconstrued phrase that he saw his biblical translation and commentary as, quote, "a first step to culture," i.e. German or European culture, in fact meant that he wished to direct his fellow Jews back to the Hebrew Bible. There was much interest for this work and attracted about 800 subscribers from France, Italy, Austria, Bohemia, Holland, Denmark, England, and Poland, Austria. Alam Latrufa, a pamphlet describing the Bier and containing a sample translation and commentary, was circulated to raise interest and gain subscribers. It contained no rabbinical approbations, and thus it aroused the suspicion of Rabbi Michesko Landau of Prague, the Nod of Yehuda. To counter this, Mendelssohn sent him a letter saying that the Bier was different, quote, We have never seen that the rabbinical authorities have taken an interest in a book written in Judeo-German to agree to its printing or to protest to its author. If I should ever write a work in Hebrew, I shall surely ask the sage of Israel and receive their permission and approbation, as I am obligated to do. End quote. After Alam Latrufa was distributed, however, Shlomo Dubno did actually receive three approbations in 1778, but he printed those only after the beer was completed in 1783. Arpersha Lewin, the head of the Berlin Community Court, provided an approbation in which he echoed a number of Mendelssohn's own justifications, including the inadequacy of the extant Yiddish translation, the need to avoid Christian ones, and the merit of having a reliable text with pious commentary. The second approbation was from Rabbi Saul Berlin, Zvi Hirsch's son, who served as a rabbi of the Frankfurt on Oder community, and the third was from the Beis Din of Berlin. After the beer was published, Mendelssohn heard rumors that Rabbi Cheskel Lando of Prague was furious and planned to ban it. Upon hearing this, Mendelssohn wrote, quote, "What have they seen concerning this matter, and what has come on to them when they sentenced me without a trial and lawful process?" End quote. Robert Volkhorn of Hamburg-Altona, however, was open with this criticism. Hennings, Mendelssohn's Danish friend, offered to involve the authorities to block by police measure what he perceived as religious fanaticism. Mendelssohn asked him to refrain. He believed the truth would win out. Mendelssohn did recommend, however, that subscriptions to the beer be taken out of the name of the Danish king, Christian VII, the heir to the throne, and other state officials. This granted them a measure of immunity. In September 1779, Mendelssohn was able to inform Hennings, quote, "My rabbis have been rather quiet of late. What has caused the silence, I do not know. It was surely not some bitter understanding on their part. Judging from a correspondence that came into my hands by chance, they seem to be rather determined not to change their mind. As for me, I have no intention of either challenging or ridiculing them. After all, what would it profit me to put the scholars of my nation up to ridicule?" The response of the rabbis to the Book of the Paths of Peace was hardly uniform, but a ban was not pronounced, nor was it burnt. There is no historical evidence that the Vilna Gaon ever criticized Mendelssohn's Bible translation or the beer. In fact, most orders from Poland came from Vilna. Initially, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, perhaps the foremost rabbinic authority of his day, defended Mendelssohn's reputation, and his son subscribed to the translation and recommended it. Rabbi Landau's objection was only that the Bible translation should not be used for teaching Bible to Jewish children. Only after the Haskalah went on the offensive did Rabbi Landau criticize Mendelssohn. The Jewish people knew that Mendelssohn could be called upon when they were in danger or when their religious practices were being attacked by the authorities. In 1772, the community of Mecklenburg-Schwerin turned to Mendelssohn for help. The Duke of that province had issued an edict that prohibited the accepted Jewish custom of burying the dead as soon as possible. Contemporary medical practice recommended a 3-day waiting period to certify death. Mendelssohn succeeded in getting the order rescinded by suggesting a compromise, that the Jews continue the practice of early burial, but first obtain medical certification, the assumption being that in most cases a few hours would be adequate to establish the fact of death. Yet Mendelssohn also wrote a private rebuke to the leaders of the community, arguing that he saw no reason to retain that custom. He asserted the convergence of contemporary medical knowledge with early Jewish ritual, claiming that, quote, "the sages and the doctors are of one mind," end quote. Upon learning of Mendelssohn's position, Reb Emden, who had also been approached regarding this issue, accused him of twisting the meaning of the text and of employing pilpul to justify his position. While this disagreement made Reb Emden warn Mendelssohn that some people were beginning to question his orthodoxy, did not damage their relationship or have any further consequences, especially since Mendelssohn had successfully resolved the community's problem, and the disagreement remained a private matter. The disagreement became public knowledge only much later, when an enterprising Moscow, Isaac Yukko, published the correspondence in 1785. In 1775, when the authorities of two Swiss villages denied their Jewish inhabitants the right to marry, Mendelssohn enlisted the help of Johann Caspar Lavater, a Swiss clergyman, to have the ban rescinded. When hundreds of Jewish families were threatened with expulsion from Dresden in 1777, Mendelssohn was able to secure the withdrawal of the edict through his close friendship with the leading official of Saxony. In the same year, the Jewish community of Königsberg appealed to him to refute the accusations that the prior Olenu was anti-Christian. Mendelssohn presented written evidence to the contrary, and as a result, the royal order requiring the presence of a government official in the synagogue during worship was rescinded. Next chapter, Naftali Hertz Wesley, the challenge of the Haskalah, and the rabbinic reaction. Naftali Hertz Wesley, a younger contemporary of Mendelssohn, clearly belongs to the first generation of Maskilim. He worked with a group who saw themselves as Maskilim and actively challenged the authority of the rabbinic elite. In 1782, Wesley wrote a pamphlet, Divrei Shalom V'Emes, to boost Jewish support for Joseph II's educational reforms. In this 8-page open letter, Wesley called for radical change in Jewish society and education. Man, claimed Wesley, is endowed with reason and capable of constructing his own world without dependence on heavenly instructions. He acquires knowledge, develops science, builds states, improves the economy, and invents. Wesley was dissatisfied that for generations Jews had been isolating themselves from society. In the distant past, the Jews lived like other nations and maintained their state. However, their long exile distanced them from normal life and plunged them into darkness. Wesley placed the blame on the rulers of Europe, who humiliated the Jews, oppressed their spirits, and excluded them from politics, science, and culture. However, Wesley continued, in the late 18th century, the leaders of the Ashkenaz rabbinical elite share in the blame, particularly at a time when the spirit of tolerance was growing in Europe. Moreover, he argued, as a result of educational reforms, religious studies would regain a status of respect and young Jewish businessmen would be less inclined to show indifference to religious obligation and leave Judaism. Wesley described how the very first encounter of these uneducated Jews with European culture threw them straight into the open arms of atheism and into the bosom of the, quote, society of those who have forgotten God. Wesley argued that people are created with different talents and abilities, and that not all Jews were meant to be Talmudic scholars. In fact, only a few students actually realized the ideal of Talmudic scholarship, but any other occupation is recognized as a necessity only after the fact. Wesley was now trying to turn the reality that existed after the fact into one that was desirable from the outset. He thus proposed a new curriculum that would include a foreign language, science, history, mathematics, and geography. Wesley urged the Jews of Europe to oust the Polish teachers, quote, who speak in a poor tongue and have taught us rude and common phrases, unquote, and perpetuate ignorance and isolation. He urged them to shun the Yiddish language, which exasperated their segregation, and to adopt the language of the land. Wesley included two statements that were sure to incur the wrath of the rabbis. He wrote that, quote, a child should not leave the class in which he learns the reading and grammar of languages for the class in which the Torah and the faith, as well as some of moral doctrines, are taught before he has examined and found to have completed this course, end quote. This, of course, was preposterous. Why should a child be barred from the study of Torah before he had passed an examination in grammar of languages? In his zeal, Wesley also included the aphorism, the sages, quote, the sages said, a Talmud Chacham, one who knows the laws of God and his Torah, who has no Deya, a carcass is better than him. For one who has no Deya will provide pleasure neither to the Jewish sages nor to the wise of other nations, for he denigrates the Torah and is repulsive to people. End quote. Not only was Wesley advocating a radical change in Jewish education, but he was viewed as insulting those sages who are ignorant of the natural sciences. The rabbis reacted swiftly to Wesley's attack. Rabbi David Tevel, the rabbi of the Lissa community in western Poland, interpreted Wesley's open letter as a threat to the supreme value of Torah study. Permitting students to choose between various tracks in Jewish education posed a grave danger. In 1782, on Shabbos HaGadol, he rose to the pulpit of the great synagogue to deliver a scathing sermon. Quote, "Who are you, Wesley? Who are you? A man poor in knowledge, the worst kind of layman, who has offered hasty counsel to innocent, wise, and intelligent men as if you are an eminent scholar. Who appointed you spokesman for the Jews? He has no part or share in the profundities of the Talmud, the early commentaries, or the oral law. How does he have the audacity to say, 'I shall offer counsel'? How does this man, who does not possess any of the foundations of wisdom, come forth to teach us the proper curriculum and to instruct this people in the ways of God? I deplore the act of this man, a hypocrite, an evildoer, a boor, the worst kind of layman, by the name of Hurst Wesley from Berlin. Proud and haughty is this enemy of the Jews, who is a threat to our very lives. He is excommunicated, banned, and cursed with the blowing of the shofar and the extinguishing of candles, for he is accused, accursed, and damned, cut off from the congregation of Israel. He has no part or share in the God of Israel. He adheres to alien views like those of the naturalists." End quote. The last accusation was groundless and certainly cannot be deduced from anything Wesley's work. Reptavel did not develop it further beyond a single sentence. Reptavel had previously written an approbation for a grammar book written by Wesley and is now determined to deny him that legitimacy and to disassociate himself from the intellectual elite. He had relented and agreed to grant the approbation only after other rabbis and Lissa had urged him to do so, claiming that there was no cause for concern since Wesley's grammar book was not a halachic work. Of course, in hindsight, Reptavel very much regretted giving his approbation and now announced that he was rescinding it. According to rumors that reached Reptavel, in the community of Vilna, they burned Wesley's open letter in the city streets and first hung it by an iron chain in the courtyard of the synagogue. Divrei Shalom Ve'Emes was burned as a heretical book, just as 10 years earlier, the writings of Hasidim were burned and ridiculed in ceremonies under the supervision of the Gra. That same year, Rabbi Cheskel Lando delivered a sermon applauding the Edict of Tolerance issued by Emperor Joseph II. He too denounced Divrei Shalom Ve'Emes and its author. Quote, "An evil man has arisen from our own people and brazenly asserted that the Torah is not all important, that an animal carcass is more worth than Talmudic scholars, that etiquette is more vital than the Torah. He is worse than an animal carcass, and in the end his corpse will lie like dung upon the field." End quote. He asked other rabbis to publicize the wickedness of the wicked Hurst Wesley, may his name be publicly banned. However, he did not endorse the principle of normal schools. However, he did endorse the principle of normal schools in which Jews would learn a general curriculum from teachers not trained in Talmud. Such teachers must not, however, transmit any criticism of the Jewish tradition. In response to the attacks against him, Wesley published a second version of his pamphlet, which he titled Rav Tov of Nei Yisrael. In that second version, he spoke in contradictory voices. On the one hand, he was apologetic, claiming that he is a God-fearing Jew, and that he was misunderstood and misjudged by his opponents. On the other hand, he did not hesitate to proclaim his autonomy of thought and right to freely and openly express his views, and he declared that he was not subject to the will of the rabbis. He also quoted from the preface of Mendelssohn's Bier, which Mendelssohn called for the rabbis to voluntarily forbear using their power of excommunication. After reading this, Rabbi Landau wrote, quote, "Now I see that every offense we have found him to be guilty of was all true. He has declared himself that he has no share in the God of Israel, nor in his Torah, and that every man may do as his heart desires. Moreover, he has printed his words in a foreign tongue, and to the monarchs he has spoken ill of the sages of Israel." Rabbi Landau was upset not only because Wesley was refusing to bend to the will of the rabbis, but also because Mendelssohn had written his preface in German and looked as if he were informing on the rabbis and showing his contempt for them. The story of Wesley continued with some interesting turns of events. I will leave those for the reader to discover. The next chapter is titled Hamaaseif. The scholar began according to Moshe Pelley when a group of aspiring Hebrew writers, undertook a new and daring enterprise, the publication of an up-to-date Hebrew journal, Hamaaseif. The Gatherer. It appeared monthly during the period 1783 to 96 and served as the mouthpiece for a movement that made a concerted effort to change the nature of Jewish society in Germany. The stated aim of the journal was to publish articles in five categories: poetry, articles on language, Bible, knowledge and ethics, halacha, and moral and physical education, biographies, news of contemporary events, and information about new books. These writers, who became known as the Hamaasvim, did not have a unified, well-developed ideology. They were, however, united in their aim to enlighten the Jewish people about the surrounding culture and the sciences, and revive the Hebrew language while remaining faithful and loyal to Judaism. The journal's launch was coupled with the formation of a new association, Society for the Seekers of the Hebrew Language. This cultural society founded a publishing house that managed to print an impressive number of Hebrew books on a variety of topics. There was great disappointment among the Maskilim when Hamaasov ceased publishing due to a lack of public interest. Yuko, in 1800, bemoaned the changing times that had caused its demise. Quote, "The days of love have passed. Gone are the days of the covenant between the Hebrew language and the children of Israel. They have run away, and they have gone." End quote. Next chapter is titled Conclusion. No two Maskilim were alike, and the nature of the Haskalah varied over time and from one geographic location to another. While most of the early Maskilim were God-fearing people who wanted to reform within the framework of Halacha, others were far more radical. But did the Haskalah itself lead to massive assimilation and apostasy? The prevailing popular belief is that yes, the Maskilim and their Haskalah caused assimilation and apostasy. However, both Sorkin and Finer argue emphatically that this is not the case. The Haskalah was not the cause, but the effect. In many geographic areas, the Jewish communal structure and the authority of the rabbinate were weakened by internal strife. What about the Messianic and Hasidic communities? As the Enlightenment swept through Europe, many economic and social barriers that separated Jews from the surrounding cultures were removed by government edict, and new opportunities were now available to the Jews. How was the Jewish community to respond to these changes? Should the status quo be retained, with the hope that the opportunities and freedoms brought about by the Enlightenment would be ignored by the masses, or should changes be implemented to address the new reality? According to Finer, the rabbinic elite was content to leave things as they were, while the Maskilim called for radical change in Jewish education. While the rabbinic elite and the Maskilim were busy fighting each other, the walls to the ghetto were crumbling. Many Jews saw no reason to voluntarily remain within what would now be a self-imposed ghetto. The first thing people now wanted was not a different or better education, but freedom. Freedom from their own religion and freedom to explore the world and do as they wished. They were quick to abandon their Judaism because in the new alluring world of excitement and opportunity, Judaism seemed to be offering only self-imposed isolation and poverty. Had the demands of the Maskilim been taken seriously, and had the Jewish community built many sophisticated educational institutions for Jews to receive instruction in the beauty of their own religion, along with a quality secular education, could the great afflux of Jews been avoided? We will never know. But we do know that the educational institutions that the Maskilim demanded, at least those of the early Maskilim in Germany, are very similar to many American Orthodox yeshivos. The vast majority of Orthodox Jews in the United States today are more educated and have more economic opportunity than what was envisioned by the early German Maskilim. Undoubtedly, the members of the early Haskalah would have been delighted with the education of today's American yeshiva student, and amazed with the education level of the many Orthodox Jews who continue their secular studies in universities across the country. Both Finer and Sorkin argue further that Mendelssohn was not the founder of the Haskalah. Mendelssohn, of course, did not cause the Enlightenment, and neither did he cause the Haskalah. As we have seen, yearning for knowledge of the natural sciences, advocating changes in Jewish education, and championing Jewish civil rights did not necessarily make one a Maskil. Maskil saw himself as being part of a group and acted as part of that group to challenge the rabbinic establishment and call for changes in Jewish education and society. The Maskilim saw themselves as an alternate intellectual group in competition with the rabbinic elite for the leadership of the Jewish community. Mendelssohn does not fit that profile. Although he was definitely very educated and intelligent, he did not focus on challenging the authority of the rabbinic establishment. His personal quest was for knowledge of philosophy, to counteract the disruptive influence of the Berlin Enlightenment, and to defend Judaism and to reconcile it with philosophy. His political goal was to achieve civil rights on behalf of the Jewish people. It was the younger, contemporary generation of Mendelssohn, the generation that created the literary journal Hamasef, that created the printing press of the Haskalah, and who challenged the rabbinic elite, who were the true founders of the Haskalah. What we can say about Mendelssohn is that once the Haskalah began, he was held up as its icon, as the ultimate educated and enlightened Jew who fought for Jewish rights. There is an ironic side note to the Haskalah. Originally, Lithuanian Jews turned to their co-religious in Germany and asked for their assistance to eradicate, or at least suppress, the threatened invasion of Hasidicism. The great learning and literary ability of the divine philosopher Rabbi Moshe ben Menachem was appealed to for help. Not a stone was left unturned to crush the new sect. However, the Hasidim and Misnagdim soon discovered that while they were busy fighting each other, a common enemy was undermining the ground on which they stood. The Haskalah was steadily drawing recruits from both, and it threatened ultimately to become more dangerous to both than they were to each other. It was the Haskalah, according to this view, that caused Hasidim and Misnagdim to lay down their arms and make peace with each other. Next chapter, the final chapter, is entitled The Book. Feiner's book is rich in detail and well-researched. The translation by the Hebrew is smooth and the underlying original Hebrew is not detectable. One problem with the book, however, is that in many places, the details in one chapter appear again in another. For example, although the entire Wesley affair is fully documented in Chapter 4, many of the same details appear again in Chapter 6, where Feiner discusses the rabbinic response to the Haskalah. Since this book is arranged not chronologically but topically, I am not sure that this is totally avoidable, but it is definitely disconcerting. There are occasional typos. On page 3, Feiner quotes Immanuel Kant, quote, self-incurred in this tutelage when its cause lies not in lack of reason but in lack of resolution and courage to use it without direction from another, end quote. I was baffled by that sentence until I realized that in should have been is. A gross mistake, however, appears on pages 36 to 37. Feiner writes regarding the off-sided question that was posed to Rav Emden that he gave the student permission to observe the anatomy lesson on the Sabbath. The actual responsa text, read correctly by Sorkin, shows that the opposite is indeed the case. Quote, stand aside and do not sit with those who are involved with the autopsy on the holy day of Sabbath. For even in this, due to the essence of the day, there is a definite prohibition as you have begun to notice with your own eyes. Do not search for a false justification but for truth. It is not that I am going beyond the norm and prohibiting people from merely looking, to stand near the surgeon to observe in a pleasurable manner as when people observe something new, for this surely I would not prohibit. On the contrary, I would not object at all, for this is not what I learned from my teachers. It is not unusual for me to be stringent regarding that for which there is no clear-cut prohibition, provided that would not lead to a catastrophe. However, although everyone else will be permitted to observe the autopsy, you may not, since it is in your interest to learn from the observation and to acquire through it knowledge of your profession. Such is definitely prohibited for the reason I mentioned above. Please remember what Rambam Zal wrote, that it is forbidden to learn on the Sabbath, even books of the wise, except for the Torah of God. It is thus, without any doubt, surely prohibited to learn about actions that are themselves prohibited on the Sabbath. End quote. Finally, I found it odd that Feiner's work contains no bibliography. Yet, despite the above annoyances, Feiner is an enjoyable, detailed, well-researched, and interesting book. While there are other books, such as Altman's, that provide more detail on the life of Mendelssohn, no other book provides such a wealth of information on the German Haskalah in general.